This week on Making Contact.
There's still between 2,000 and 3,000 people a day leaving their homes because of violence, sectarian violence, U.S. military operations, etc.
Change the Q in Iraq to an N in Iran and you're good to go.
The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 may have overthrown the dictatorial government of Saddam Hussein, but it has unleashed a massive sectarian civil war that, to date, seems to have no end in sight. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have been displaced, war costs are estimated at more than $1 trillion by some reports, and of course, you can't put a price tag on the U.S. military and Iraqi civilian death toll. On this edition, independent journalists David Barsamian and Dar Jamal tackle the Iraq War, U.S. foreign policy, and Iran. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, battle ideas, and important information. Dar Jamal has been covering the Middle East for more than 4 years. He's reported extensively from inside Iraq, Turkey, Syria, and Lebanon. The realities of what he saw and wrote about now appear in his new book, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. David Barsamian is an award-winning director and founder of Alternative Radio, a syndicated weekly talk program based in Boulder, Colorado. Barsamian's journalism career spanned some 30 years, with articles appearing regularly in The Progressive, The Nation, and Z magazine. Barsamian's latest book is called Targeting Iran, with Noam Chomsky, Ervan Abrahamian, and Nahid Mosafari. Both men sat down in front of an audience in San Francisco to have an open discussion about the Iraq War. Citing the Bush administration's claim that the increase in troops has produced remarkable results, Barsamian began the conversation by asking Jamal to give us his observations about what's going on inside Iraq.
Well, first of all, starting with Al-Anbar province, because that is being held up as one of the examples of the success of the so-called surge. And the reality in Al-Anbar is what's happening is a macro version of what happened in Fallujah after the April 2004 failed siege of that city, where the U.S. military couldn't take the city, so they had to save face politically and in the media. So what they did is they pulled one of Saddam's old generals out of the closet, put his uniform back on him, and said, okay, General so-and-so is in charge of the city, and then we're turning security over to the Iraqis. And so they basically armed, funded, and backed the Mujahideen in the city that, of course, at that point just put on Iraqi police uniforms and uniforms of the ICDC, the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps. And basically, they did take over control of the city. And then, of course, that set the stage, set the conditions for the second U.S. attack in November that destroyed 70% of the city, killed thousands of Iraqis and hundreds of American soldiers. And that's exactly the policy that's been used in Al-Anbar. Al-Anbar, up until just a couple of months ago, was extremely volatile, extremely violent. And the U.S. basically did a major shift in tactics to where they found several tribal leaders that they could basically buy off. And so they've been pumping millions and millions of dollars into these tribes while simultaneously giving huge amounts of weapons and ammunition and sometimes even training to various militias in Al-Anbar province. But as we can see, some of these collaborator tribal leaders, like Abu Risha was recently killed. Bush flew out to Al-Anbar, when was that, roughly, I don't know, 6-8 weeks ago.
Early September.
Right, and showed up at an air base and then brought this sheikh out there and said, look, this is the man that's leading Anbar into a new democracy. And, of course, a week later, he was killed at his home. So it's not all going exceedingly well for them. But essentially, Al-Anbar is now a ticking time bomb. Basically, these tribes are just taking the money and the arms and biding their time, I think, before it kicks off again.
Maybe as a prop. I wish these were $100 bills, but this is really what's driving the collaborators in Iraq. These are single. I'm holding it close to the microphone since we're doing radio. But if they were crisp, new $100 bills, this is essentially what is winning the loyalty of these fair-weather, sheikhs. Very interesting, the kind of colonial representations of, their Arab sheikhs, head of tribes. This is is right out of the British discourse of the 1920s when they took over Iraq.
It really is. And again, it's been good for the media, good PR, and a lot of people back here are buying it because for the moment, there are fewer U.S. casualties. But we have to also look at the fact that in addition to the buying off of the sheikhs, so to speak, we have a massive increase in air power, where in the first 6 months of this year alone, there have been five times as many bombs dropped in Iraq as compared to the first six-month period of the same six-month period of last year. And then we also look at there's been recent news, so-called news, I should say, of actually families returning back to Baghdad now. The situation's actually getting better. And the reality is that there's still between 2,000 and 3,000 people, 2,000 and 3,000 people a day leaving their homes because of violence, sectarian violence, U.S. military operations, et cetera. And there have been a few odd instances now of families going back to Baghdad. And there's reports this past week quoting a spokesman for an Iraqi ministry who was appointed by Nouri al-Maliki, who of course was appointed by the Bush administration. Well, there's no democracy involved here. But this spokesman claimed that 3,000 Iraqi families had returned to their homes in Baghdad in the last couple of months. And, of course, the AP report, mentioned that, but none of this information could be corroborated. There was basically no evidence that they could cite to prove this. But the reality is that there have been a few families return, and that's because Syria, after having been visited by Maliki within the last few months, just of last month imposed new visa restrictions. So any Iraqi trying to enter Syria, which up until that time was the only restriction-free country on the planet left that Iraqis could go to, now they made it to where you had to have a visa that proved you were coming in for business or you were coming in for emergency medical treatment. And so now all these families that were daily streaming across the border into Syria are now being turned back, and either they can stay there on the border and be a refugee, or they can go back home to Baghdad and take the risk of sitting in their own home.
On trips to the Middle East that I made in 2005 and most recently in June of this year, I heard many accounts from Iraqi refugees about mercenaries opening up on them at roadblocks and random shootings and killings and literally massacres. This has been well known among the Iraqis, but didn't really break into any kind of consciousness here in the United States until September of 2007, when the Blackwater incident happened, where 17 Iraqis were killed in Baghdad.
Right, and this is a situation that I know that you and I have talked about it at least off tape in the past. I can't remember if it's been on program, mm-hmm. but yeah, it's common knowledge. I mean, we've known this has been going on in Iraq from the very beginning with these. And Blackwater is just one of over 100 mercenary companies operating in Iraq, completely out of any jurisdiction whatsoever, immune to Iraqi law. The couple of times they've actually been busted for something, they've been immediately flown out of the country to avoid prosecution of any kind and then brought back here. And, of course, nothing happens to them once they get home. But Iraqis from my very first trip in there in November 2003 were regularly talking about these cowboys driving around in these usually white armored SUVs. They usually have a tail gunner, literally a tail gunner in the back. They take out the back window and there's a guy sitting behind a big metal barricade with his machine gun poking out of it, guns bristling out of the windows, driving down the highways or the roads in Baghdad and literally shooting, popping their guns off if cars get in the way. And if anyone gets too close, they'll just shoot into the car. So this type of thing has been absolutely rampant. And another thing sort of unrelated that I wanted to ask you, David, is you know, there's so much talk of the Bush administration now regarding Iran, all of this bellicose rhetoric. And one thing I've been talking about as part of my book tour is reminding people of September 6, 2002, when then White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card was talking about the PR campaign in the Iraq war and saying, we don't launch new products in August. And on September 6, 2002, that's exactly what he did, is he launched a PR campaign to invade Iraq. And it was the next day that Bush and Blair stood in Camp David and declared they had evidence of the IAEA report proving that Iraq was 6 months away from nuclear weapons, and which didn't exist, of course. And so the campaign was launched. And this September, we've seen a very, very similar campaign launched against Iran.
Yeah, there was a series of these, what I call electronic Nuremberg rallies, orchestrated events with pre-selected, actually, to get a good sense of this, one should watch Leni Riefenstahl's fantastic documentary called Triumph of the Will, which is a recording of the 1934 Nazi Party rally at Nuremberg. And you'll see remarkable similarities between what was going on then in terms of orchestrating mass appeal, the flags, the torches, the handsome men, you know, marching in lockstep. And Bush, right away, right after around Labor Day, had four such opportunities to introduce a new product. He went to such audiences as the Veterans for Foreign War, the American Legion. Then he went to the Marine Base in Quantico, Virginia. And then he flew to Anbar Province in the middle of the night, top secret. Nobody knew about it since Iraq is such a success story. You didn't want anything to happen to him. And it was the same kind of thing of audiences that will naturally salute and applaud and cheer and hoo-ha the commander-in-chief, retired as well as present military. And these were designed precisely now to move Iraq kind of to the sidelines, since it is such a great success. And Afghanistan, of course, we can't even talk about. That's an even more grand success. So let's ratchet up a new enemy du jour. And why not Iran? Iran has been in their targets for years. I mean, they've never accepted the Islamic Revolution of 1979. There's payback, you know, dealing with the hostage crisis of that period as well. And Iran has also a tremendous amount of grapes and watermelons and pomegranates, which, of course, attract such U.S. corporations as ExxonMobil and Chevron Texaco and ConocoPhillips. So that's, you know, all the more reason to go after Iran. Plus, you have a very simple clerical matter. You had all of these propaganda tropes, press releases, documents, reports that all had Iraq on them. Now you can just go and tweak them, change the Q in Iraq to an N in Iran, and you're good to go. And the corporate media is just so willing to be a transmission belt for the same propaganda. Iran is a threat. Iran is a growing danger. We are in great danger. We have to do something. You know, civilization is at stake. Very apocalyptic language, very reminiscent, almost verbatim, from the kind of propaganda that was rolled out in 2002 and 2003. So I think we're in a very dangerous period. And all the, you know, the intellectuals, you know, the serious people that go on the News Hour with Jim Lehrer and the Charlie Rose Show, and you hear them on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, they're saying, well, you know, this is all saber rattling, it's gunboat diplomacy. They can't possibly be even thinking of attacking Iran. I mean, the army's way overextended, the generals are complaining, there's Afghanistan, the National Guard is depleted, the reserves are exhausted, the equipment is not being replaced fast enough because of the horrible weather conditions. Again, blame it on the Arabs in Iraq, and, you know, the Afghans, who are not Arabs, blame it on them. But, you know, all of these rational arguments belie the fact that we're dealing with very irrational people in the White House, people who are armed, who have a history of violence, and may indeed continue along that pattern. And I think there's a South African saying, a dying bull kicks the hardest. And these guys are dying. You know, the neocon project is on its last legs. And so they may, in fury and anger and vengeance and retribution, lash out against Iran. So it's a very dangerous moment.
You've been listening to David Barsamian and Dar Jamal, independent journalists in conversation at a live audience recording in San Francisco. Coming up next.
We're not dealing with rational people in Washington. This is the big conundrum.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. For more information, for a CD copy of this program, or to get in touch with Dar Jamal or David Barsamian, please call 800-529-5736 or go to our website at radioproject.org. You can also download programs or get our podcast from our site as well. Dar Jamal writes for the Inner Press Service and the Asia Times. His work has appeared in The Nation, The Sunday Herald, and Foreign Policy in Focus, to name a few. His first radio documentary, The Growing Iraqi Refugee Crisis, aired on our show in July of 2007. As a writer, David Barsamian is probably best known for his series of interviews with Noam Chomsky, which were published in book form and translated into many languages. Hundreds of thousands of copies were sold worldwide. We now return to the conversation between these two journalists, who are discussing the current momentum for aggression against Iran.
So part of that propaganda campaign against Iran then is framing Iraq as a success of, as you said, Bush coming into Al-Anbar in the dead of night, showing up, and then these recent reports this last week about, well, some refugees are returning to their homes in Baghdad, and there is less sectarian violence, and troop deaths are down. So all of this, I mean, looking at it through the lens of a PR campaign against Iran, I mean, this is just kind of the Iraq mess that we have to at least make look a little bit more respectable, clean it up a little bit as we keep the train heading towards Tehran.
Well, I think Tehran's always been in their gun sights. Iraq was just supposed to fall like a house of cards, and then the guns were going to turn toward Iran. That was the plan. Of course, the Iraqis had other ideas. They didn't find occupation a delightful experience. It wasn't pleasurable for a lot of Iraqis, and so they resisted. And so that juggernaut was halted in Iraq, but clearly the gun sights were aimed at Iran from the get-go. You know, it is a charter member of the Axis of Evil.
And do you have, if and when the U.S. air attack on Iran begins, do you have any ideas or predictions of where you see that might taking things, not just in Iran, but in the broader Middle East?
Well, we don't have to go very far. We just passed a couple of gas stations where the price of gasoline was $3.50 a gallon, and just flip those numbers around. It'll be $6.50, $7.50, $8.50, $9.50 a gallon. There will be an enormous crisis, an economic crisis, because of the escalation in the price of oil. But Iran can, I mean, this is what the experts are saying, Iran can strike back. Iran has assets in Afghanistan, in Iraq, of course, where 65% of the population is their Shia co-brethren. And many of the political leadership in Iraq owe their allegiance to Tehran. So, you know, they're trying to scapegoat Iran. And Iran can, you know, close the Strait of Hormuz, which is this narrow choke point. It's about 30 miles wide between the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean. That's where most of the world's oil tankers pass through. It wouldn't be very difficult to either place mines in the strait to close it, or actually sink some of the oil tankers going through. I mean, just think about the ramifications of that on the world economy. Catastrophic would not be an overstatement.
How and why, you know, should we really even take seriously that they're going to contemplate an air attack against Iran?
Well, read. You don't have to read between the lines. You can read the lines. Cheney's, read their lips. They are saying, we will not leave the White House in 2009, if they in fact leave at that time. I suspect they will, though. We will not leave the White House with Iran on track, you know, to get a weapons program. And so they've openly announced their intentions to carry out a military attack. People like Bill Kristol in the Weekly Standard, Norman Podoritz in commentary, cheering them on, Ann Coulter, Ann Bayefsky, Glenn Beck. There's a whole right-wing media chorus saying, get this over with now. What are you waiting for? You don't want to wait until they get nuclear weapons. You want to hit them now while you can still, you know, destroy them. And so, yes, it seems totally irrational, but we're not dealing with rational people in Washington. This is the big conundrum.
And then now we look at what's happening in Pakistan, and I know you're about to go to Pakistan soon, and at the risk of getting a little far ahead of ourselves, but I don't think we are when we look at the daily events right now in Pakistan, which has nuclear weapons. Extremely, extremely unstable government. And I know that you have plans to go there soon. Could you talk a little bit about what you're observing happening in Pakistan right now and why?
Well, the U.S. has backed the military regime of Pervez Musharraf since he seized power in 1999. He's kind of been our boy, very much the way Suharto was our boy in Jakarta for many, many years, someone that we can work with. There was an interesting statement made by Musharraf's information minister the other day. He said, we know the Americans. If they have to choose between stability and democracy, they'll choose stability every time. Mm-hmm. And this is why we wind up supporting the Somozas and the Batistas and the other dictators around the world, because we value so-called moderation and stability over all other things. Of course, these are code words for subordination and servility. Not stability. They will follow orders from Washington. So Musharraf has been coddled by Washington for many years. Incidentally, billions of dollars have gone into the coffers of mostly his friends in the Pakistani military. And there's been very little accounting of that money, just like the money missing in Iraq. You know, billion here, billion there. You remember Everett Dirksen? Pretty soon you're talking real money. And so Pakistan has been a highly militarized state in its almost 60 years of history since it became an independent state when the British divided India into two states. Almost 30 to 40 years of that period, the country's been ruled by the military. The military is the main force that controls politics inside of Pakistan. Now, there's a lot of hoopla around Benazir Bhutto and, you know, she's some kind of shining Democrat. You know, we live in the United States of amnesia, as Gore Vidal says, you know, the USA. There's no memory. There's no memory that she was twice driven from office in Pakistan in the 1990s because of some of the most outrageous corruption scandals, even by Pakistani standards, that have ever been seen. I mean, huge swaths of money simply went missing. And so now she is being, you know, posited as some kind of a democratic alternative. I mean, this all is tied into the Afghan war, the support for the Mujahideen, you know, that were called the freedom fighters by Reagan, many of whom then were turned into Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. You know, actions have consequences. Like, you know, in the Iran book, Targeting Iran, a democratic government is in Iran in 1953. What does the United States do? It overthrows it. Actions have consequences. And then the Shah comes back into power. 25 years of tyranny and oppression, that leads to the Islamic Revolution. We saw the same kind of thing in Afghanistan with, you know, the morphing of the Taliban. So I think, you know, Pakistan is extremely volatile and very fragile.
And now, as we speak, the Taliban are in control of a certain percentage of the country. And it's at least right now, it's increasing as we speak. And so, like, how many steps are there between where we are today to a situation where that government may well be overthrown and someone with at least even stronger ties to the Taliban than Musharraf does could come into power? I mean, how realistic is a scenario like that?
It's plausible. I mean, we can't say with any degree of certainty, but, you know, we don't have to speculate. Pakistan has already trafficked in this kind of knowledge through the Abdul Qadir Khan network. He was a famous Pakistani scientist who sold, for money. This was totally not altruistic at all. He did it for money. He sold weapons secrets to various countries. And so there's already an enormous amount of information out there that comes out of Pakistan and has proliferated now around the world. You know, it's like what Oppenheimer said, or someone dealing with the Manhattan Project when the U.S. developed the atomic bomb. Once this genie's out of the bottle, it's very difficult to put it back in. And once this this information about how to assemble a bomb, you know, how to achieve, you know, how to process uranium and all of those things, then it's very, very difficult to contain it. So I think, you know, we can't underestimate the dangers that are out there, but I'm very fearful that Washington's policies are not going to go in the direction that's really required to temper, you know, some of these very extreme tendencies, and it seems that they're trying to actually fuel them. If there is a demand to dismantle the empire, to create a country that is caring for its citizens, that is caring for the earth, that will participate in mending and healing our planet, which is just hemorrhaging all over the place, then I think there's, you know, a real possibility for change. Many people say, you know, there's no draft, that's why there'll be no organized resistance. I'd like to think that, you know, we're somehow better than that, that we don't need something like a military draft to call people's attention to justice. Justice is the highest calling, as Daniel Webster said. The work of humankind on earth is the work for justice. And I think, you know, we can never cease in that endeavor.
And I think that we all have to decide what's our red line, and when has that red line been crossed? And for most of us, I think it probably was crossed a long, long time ago, years ago. And then, therefore, what am I willing to do to try to make this a better place? Or what am I willing to do, not even just for that, but so that I can sleep at night, personally? Because I think if we look at the big picture now, it's so overwhelming. Climate change, what's being done to the earth, these wars, the potential for nuclear war, on a broader scale in the Middle East, it's horrifying. And then if you look at how corrupt our political system is, what's the hope of changing it? And it's kind of like that part in The Hobbit where, or, you know, in The Lord of the Rings, where everything's so overwhelmingly against us that there's just no way short of a miracle. And I think that it's really not our place to look at that. But as David said, it's what is the moral and just thing to do? And it's the right thing to do. Basically, that us as individuals need to do the opposite of Conyers and Pelosi, where they say, well, I'm just being realistic. We probably don't have the votes, so therefore I'm not going to do it. It's like, no, I'm going to go do the right thing because it's the right thing to do and because it's the moral thing to do. And then the results are going to, those will come down where they come down. But I think it's up to us, each of us right now, to go do that moral thing, whatever it is for each one of us as an individual.
That was Dar Jamal in conversation with David Barsamian at an event benefit for Making Contact in San Francisco in November 2007. Jamal's nonprofit work is a fiscally sponsored project of Making Contact, and David Barsamian was one of the founders of National Radio Project. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, and the Monday Morning Breakfast crew, and to Elena Botkin-Levy, who helped produce this show. For a CD copy of program number 4907, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Puck Lowe, associate producer, Joaquin Palomino, Samson Rainey, and Elena Botkin-Levy, interns, and I'm senior producer Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.